I'm Are You Serious? And this is my
show. Show.
Natural disasters,
and eventually the end of the world. Are you serious? Cory Doctorow is just named God of the Internet or Chief Poobah or something like that by Forbes magazine, and I'm very jealous. But he's going to be on our show today, which should be fine. But first, we do have Jeff Deal, Steve Robles, and our usual gang of three, topped off by Diana Brown.
Topped off. I feel like a freshly poured pint of Guinness. That's a beautiful thing. We know it's said that there is no there in Oakland, and according to Sir Ken MacDonald, there is no war there in Britain, war on terror, I mean. According to an article in The Guardian, it seems Sir Kenneth MacDonald has put himself at odds with the Home Secretary and Downing Street last night by denying, well, actually not last night, a few nights ago, I stand corrected, by denying that Britain is caught up in a war on terror and calling for a culture of legislative restraint in passing laws that deal with terrorism. And, you know, he goes on to talk about how it's not a war on terror, it's an effort to control the criminal element that's running rampant in the streets. And of course he goes on to say, let's not throw away our freedoms, let's not toss out the baby with the bathwater. And that sounds really familiar, doesn't it? Are you
Have I been tossing out babies lately? I tossed a few babies out the window.
I'm not suggesting
that. I hope you've been tossing out the bathwater.
Maybe that's where he's going to
bath the water for days at a time.
You're fortunate. You know, in the Old West.
We've sort of had this discussion before about the linguistic frame, war on terror.
Exactly.
Which always, you know, seemed like bullshit.
Well, it sounds like he's talking about something different there. It sounds like he's talking
about... Well, his piece was pretty moderate. I mean, it was pretty, like, sane, and there are a number of quotes in there that recognize that there is a problem or a threat from lunatics who happen to believe in Islam blowing themselves up and so forth.
Is he given that old distinction about treating it as a war versus treating it as a criminal thing?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's
law
basically
enforcement.
Exactly right. The idea that
law enforcement, yeah.
You know, it doesn't really come up to the level of a war, both tactically and in terms of what's happening to people on our end. And I think, you know,
I remember that 5 minutes when we had that debate in this country over whether it should be treated as a war or
there wasn't much of a debate.
Yeah,
there
it was 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
It was actually dismissed. Yeah, that was brought up as it was being.
You're being generous in 5 minutes.
And I thought to myself, this is going to be trouble.
Right.
No, the most compelling argument.
People accuse John Kerry of wanting to treat it as a criminal thing rather than
law enforcement issue.
A law enforcement issue, and he sort of, you know, being John Kerry, sort
ran
of waffled somewhere in the middle of.
Well, that's that classic, you know, one of those things that paints Democrats as pussies.
Right.
For me, the most potent argument against it is there is a defeatist kind of attitude about it, that these idiots that are proponents of it don't really realize that a war in people's minds is something that's fought on a finite basis. Whereas if you turn it over to law enforcement, there's a psychology of there's a natural psychology of like the battle never ends with law enforcement.
You've got it backwards, man. You're totally backwards.
Yeah, we have wars that never end.
The war on drugs.
Poverty, war on poverty. I guess they gave up on that one. They did surrender the war on
poverty.
Failure was the option.
In fact, it was pussies who were for the war on poverty. So it was easy.
I think even like war on drugs, I think maybe even is used less and less because they start to realize that, like, in people's minds, war is something that's like...
No, people grow fatigued of a war that goes on and on and on.
No, that's what I'm saying. So in terms of that nomenclature, I think they're stopped. I don't think they're using war on drugs as much because people are going, well, when are we going to win?
They're not using it as much because they're all talking about the war on terror. It's just taken,
but the second place. The thing about the, it going on and on with treating it as a law enforcement issue is kind of true, but that's valid in the sense that there's always going to be criminals.
Right.
No, but the point is you treat it as particular criminal acts and particular perpetrators, and then you go after them, find the evidence, and convict them if you can, instead of calling it a war, which means you can just summon the military to go to some place and start killing whoever they want without any oversight or any kind of
I'm saying people are more willing to tolerate in their minds the idea of it as a law enforcement issue law enforcement never ends. It keeps going and going and going.
I said that was the reason why people would reject it.
No. I'm saying that these fucking idiots, their proponents of the term, are asshats.
What term?
The war on terror, the war on drugs.
Well, Sir Ken McDonald agrees with you. I mean, he feels that there is no war on terror any more than there's a war on drugs in the streets. And then
I think it's more than just a series of criminal acts where you can go after specific perpetrators. I mean, it's a kind of mimetic poison that is pretty widespread in the Islamic world, and you can't really just go after it by saying, who's responsible for these acts? Let's go and arrest them. You have to somehow deal with the mimetic poison, which is also a response to I'm talking about the
mimetic poison.
The people who have the idea that they should spread jihad.
Well, you're saying that there's two battles to fight here. There's the actual arresting the assholes that are like putting together the bombs that are going on the trains, and then there's the larger battle of addressing this ideology that is, fueling this kind of behavior.
Well, Sir Ken warned that the pernicious risk that a fear-driven and inappropriate response to the threat would lead Britain to abandon respect for fair trials, and I think that's what we're really afraid of in this country, that we don't want to just abandon all of our freedoms and our rights in the name of let's wipe out the enemy. And that's kind of the thing that we're seeing. A lot of people are losing their rights. People are being detained without any hope of getting out because, when the war on terror is over, you're going to get out. But when is the war on terror ever going to end? And, he finishes up by saying we must protect ourselves from these atrocious crimes without abandoning our traditions and freedom.
Yeah, but do you think people who are saying this sort of thing are going to have very much impact? Does anybody think that
I don't know. Rational minds tend to be silenced in times of complete chaos.
Well, nobody cares what this particular guy's talking about. First of all, he's British, and second of all, he's not like a not a very well-known British person, if there's even such a thing. But I mean, whatever. It looks like there's been a turning of the tide in this country a little bit or something. People might be more open to the idea of treating terrorism as a law enforcement type issue. We might start heading towards that if we ever end the war in Iraq, but in general, we probably still would rather bomb people.
Yeah, it's more exciting.
When the beam of light is broken by a solid object, such as this head, the electric eye control opens the faucet, and there's your drink.
Cory Doctorow is a science fiction writer, a co-editor of Boing Boing, and he was director of European Affairs for the Electronic Frontier Foundation from 2001 through 2006. His novels include Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom and Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. And today we'll be talking about his new collection of short stories, Overclocked, and welcome, Cory.
Hi there.
Hi. So before we go into the content of the book itself, you make quite a prominent point about the fact that the book is available for free under a Creative Commons license, and you make also a point that you've had a good experience as a writer who does want to get paid for his work doing this. Do you think this good experience is universal, and has this been studied at all, to your knowledge?
Well, I don't know that anyone's done any kind of systematic study, although, the number of emails I get from academics who are like, well, I'm doing some kind of paper on this, do you think we could talk about it? If I answered them all, I'd never actually get any work done. I just talked to people who are studying the work I was doing. But my anecdotal study of this is that everyone I know who's tried giving away free ebooks as a way of selling printed books has done it again, done it with their next book. So, you know, I think that's a pretty good sign, right? It worked well enough for people to do it a second time. I guess the formal definition of insanity is doing something twice and expecting a different outcome. So presumably people were happy with that first outcome.
And about how many people would you say that you hear from who are doing this sort of thing?
You know, at least 10 or 15 writers, for sure, who've done this with their novels. And, of course, you know, a lot more musicians and things, too. You know, in a certain sense, I kind of live in the bubble of people who've done this, right? I mean, there are kind of all my friends are the people who've done this. But, you know, it seems like it works pretty well. You know, and that makes a certain amount of sense, especially for printed material. You know, my thesis about printed material is that basically the thing that keeps people from reading long-form works off of screens isn't the screen quality or anything. It's that computers are really distracting. And so it's really hard to concentrate on one thing for a long time while you're sitting in front of a computer. And so as a result, I think people who get a novel over the wire tend to then take that novel, read some of it, get distracted, but like it well enough that they're willing to go out and buy it and read it on paper, which is a lot less distracting.
It did strike me as I was thinking about this that you were saying you're in kind of a bubble with a certain group of people. It did strike me that people who are fans of Cory Doctorow would probably be like the number one group of people who would like want this to work. And
sure.
I wonder if somebody like Chuck Palahniuk would have the same response from his readers, or if they wouldn't just be happy to grab the free stuff. Anyway.
Well, you know, like all good pirates, I steal all my best ideas. So I'll steal some good ideas from Tim O'Reilly here. So, you know, he wrote this great paper called Piracy is Progressive Taxation. And that's where this aphorism, the problem for artists isn't piracy, it's obscurity, comes from. But the other aphorism is the one that makes the title, which is Piracy is Progressive Taxation. And I think a lot of people miss what that means. So when Tim says it, he basically means, look, we publish books that get really widely pirated on the internet because, you know, O'Reilly, they publish techie books, right? If there's ever been, you know, first of all, a form that was well suited to being published digitally, because of course you get it digitally and then you can scan it and search it and so on, find just the right bit at the moment that you need that technical advice, but also because the people who are in a position to nick it electronically are also the people who are, you know, it's pre-qualified. That's also the audience, right? They're all geeks. And so what he says is, you know, we monitor the trafficking in infringing copies of our work. And what we find is that the works that are most profitable are also the most pirated. And so what that means is that, you know, for most of our works, you know, they're not even popular enough for anyone to want to steal them. And for the works that are really popular, we're already making tons and tons of money off of those works. And a little bit of piracy at the edge is just a form of progressive taxation on them.
One of the fun things about having your material or anybody's material online in this form is that you can go in and mess around with it. Have you gotten any interesting remixes of your own work?
Yeah, tons. I mean, you know, the stuff that I've really liked have been the illustrations and visual things, but also tons of really good, geeky, machine-readable remixes. You know, it seems like it's kind of like writing a Hello World program, writing a thing that cuts up a story and makes a kind of, you know, Burroughs-Geisen-esque cut-up, and so I've had a lot of those. One that I've really liked is a speed reader that people have tried out with my work. So the speed reader shows you one word at a time, and it shows them at a speed that's determined by a little slider, and it pauses a little after a comma and longer after a period and longer after a paragraph break. And you can crank it way up, and it just like rockets past, and you're getting every word. It's kind of meant for very small screens, and it really feels like you're doing something weird to your brain. Like it really feels like you're tweaking your cognition in ways that it was not intended to be tweaked. It's very transhuman.
Yeah, I mean, you see that occasionally on videos and so forth, and I think it would drive me nuts after a while, but it's also...
Sounds cool, too, because you could also, I would imagine, you could adjust the speed of the words to reflect different emphases
sure.
in the phrasing and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, although, you know, the nice thing about this is it's all machine-driven, right? I mean, yeah, someone could go in there and fix it, but the fact that this is just a purely automated conversion, it's really exciting to do it. It really, it's like you can't believe that your brain is understanding the words. It's really cool. So, you know, it's, but yeah, people have come up with all kinds of nice little mixes and translations, too. A lot of fan translations of my stuff, which is very exciting. There's a guy who just emailed me to say that one of the official translations, maybe it was the German translation, he didn't like it very much, of one of my books, and so he was going to do his own translation to compete with it. So I just think that's great. I think that's awesome.
That is really great. Let's move on.
You know, I guess the one, like I love foreign sales. I think it's great. I love getting that kind of bigger audience to people who aren't just parochial English speakers. My only regret about it is that there's so much distance between me, so many layers of intermediaries between me and my and the foreign rights sales. You know, there's my agent, then there's my agent's foreign rights deal, and then there's, you know, their translator, and then there's the guy who's actually buying it in, you know, France or whatever. But it's kind of hard to get those people on board on Creative Commons. I think I've got the French publisher on board. I'm releasing the French edition of one of my books under Creative Commons. But it's just, it requires like so much kind of hand holding and such a personal relationship with the publisher to kind of get them there at this point that I haven't been able to do it. And so I kind of feel like I'm you know, I get these kind of affronted emails from people who aren't English speakers going, you know, well, Creative Commons is good enough for English speakers, I get, but it's not good enough for us, you know, and I sympathize with them. I, you know, I just don't know how to solve it.
Mm. Let's move on to this collection, which, by the way, I enjoyed very much. So go ahead and do go out and buy it or read it online or both. My favorite piece in there, and it's deservedly the longest piece, is called After the Siege.
Definitely.
Talk a bit about the theme of that piece.
Well, so I was I went to like a family reunion in St. Petersburg, Russia, a little mini family reunion. My grandmother was born there, and her family still lives there. And my grandmother, when I was growing up, always used to tell me about the war and about being a kid during the siege of Leningrad and living through it. And how I would never understand the terrible horrors she'd had to face. I didn't know much about the Siege of Leningrad, but my understanding was, like, it wasn't anything on, like, Auschwitz, right? Like, boy, you know, how bad could it have been? You were just, like, you were a civil defense worker. You weren't in a death camp. And as my grandmother walked us through the streets of St. Petersburg and told us the stories, summer before last, so it was one of those long St. Petersburg days, long St. Petersburg nights, and told us the stories of what she saw and did during that period, it really changed my perception of it. And I went out and I read some books, most notably The 900 Days about the Siege of Leningrad. And, you know, the privation and terrors of the Siege of Leningrad can't be overstated. I mean, this was in many ways humanity at its worst and humanity at its best, but it was a 900-day siege. And Stalin bungled it so badly that, you know, people were really in bad shape in Petersburg. And there was starvation and cannibalism and lots of people freezing to death. And my grandmother, this 12-year-old girl, was digging civil defense trenches in the frozen ground and hauling bodies and throwing them out of 15-story windows because they were too weak to haul them down the stairs, you know, going to apartments where people had died and throwing them down and then scraping them up off the ground and seeing people who had been rendered by the cannibal black marketeers and had parts of their body sliced off to sell on the black market. And it was just the most amazing, incredible stories. And, you know, it got me thinking about you know, writing about this as an allegory. And at the same time, I've been doing all this work with developing nations and what they call emerging economies, which are, you know, the former Soviet territories, on copyright and related rights. And, you know, these countries are getting really shafted in international copyright negotiations, where they're being forced to sign on to these regimes that are like totally out of step with what they need. You know, America became an industrial power by being a pirate nation, right? When after the American Revolution, America didn't honor copyrights or patents for anyone except Americans. So if you're a European or British inventor, you know, your stuff could be widely pirated in America, and that's how they got rich, right? It was only when America became a net exporter of copyrighted goods that it started to enter into treaties with other countries, you know, whereby American inventors and authors would be protected abroad in exchange for those foreign authors being protected in America, but only when it was in its economic interest to do this. But you know, now you have these countries in Africa and Asia and Eastern Europe who are signing on to trade agreements with the U.S. where they basically promise to just take huge chunks of their GDP and export it to the U.S. Just become kind of information feudalists.
And when you talk about copyright, also, I mean, you're not just talking about the information, but within the context of this book and what your issues you're trying to raise, I think you're talking about material wealth as well. I think,
yeah,
and you're talking about AIDS, drugs, and stuff like that.
Absolutely. So, you know, like Russia just signed on to this free trade agreement with the U.S. Trade Representative, in which, among other things, they promised that from now on they would license all their digital media presses and subject them to government inspection, right? So America, which fought a revolution over not wanting to have licensed presses, has just gone to Russia, where they've just had a revolution over licensed presses and imposed a requirement that they license their presses on them. And this is like, it's just like staggering, awful, apocalyptically bad policymaking on the part of both the U.S. and Russia. And frankly, as someone who pays taxes in the U.S., I'm embarrassed. I mean, you know, to think that we've just imposed a requirement to license presses on a country is just disgusting. Anyway, so I wrote this story about, it's from the point of view of a little girl, in a utopia where they've done what the U.S. did after the American Revolution. They've abandoned all international copyright and patent and trademark and knowledge goods treaties, and they're just pirating everything. And it's in a kind of nanotech world where that means that you can make anything pretty much if you don't care about respecting the rights of the inventors who created it. And as a result, they've become an incredibly wealthy nation in a very short period of time. And the thing that's driven them to this is that there's a disease that turns you into a kind of zombie. It says this terrible infectious disease, and the drugs for it are very expensive, and they keep having these ineffectual leaders who are being co-opted by the pharmaceutical companies who promise that they'll make the drugs available and who don't. And so eventually they take the last of these leaders and they put them in a barrel and drive nails through it and roll it down a hill, which is in fact how the Hungarians killed the priest who converted the animists to Christianity. And they put in a new parliament that breaks all ties with the industrial world and decides to just pirate everything. And a siege is laid against them. And among the things that happens in the siege is they infect the computers and the other devices of this little republic with a virus that shuts down all their nanoassemblers, and they all start to starve to death. And it's told from the point of view of this little girl who comes of age in this world, and the zombieism comes back and so on. So it was a fun and hard story to write, and I'm really, really happy with how it turned out. So it's been picked up for a couple of the year's best anthologies, and it's been podcasted by me, and I'm talking with someone about a film deal for it. So that seems to be a lot of people's favorites.
Yeah, I thought of that as being particularly cinematic as well, and that the point of view of the 12-year-old girl always seems to be particularly affecting. I remember the book "Let's Put the Future Behind Us." I'm not thinking of the author's name, but
Jack Womack. Yeah, I'm a big Jack Womack fan.
Incredibly powerful. Yeah.
That one and the other one, the one about the young girl in Brooklyn, whose name I'm drawing a blank on. Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, of course, and there's so many of these it's a real good point of view, as you say.
But my favorite part in that story actually was the role played by the wizard and his crew, which I think explores the ambiguities of being in the media, and I must admit I sort of identified with them. And I wonder if you did too.
Yeah, so in the story, there's this guy who's identified only as the wizard, who seems to be in better shape than everyone else. He's got access to working technology, and it turns out that he's kind of a documentarian. He's working for foreign media, just recording what's going on. And that, I think, also reflects, you know, one of the roles that bloggers and technical people have. We often find ourselves as kind of reporters on what goes on in the rest of the world, and at a certain reporterly distance from what goes on in the rest of the world. That character is really based on the character the King in the James Clavell King Rat books, the American black marketeer in the Changi prison Japanese prisoner of war camp, who has access to all the stuff that it takes to be human, and so he's the only one who's kind of fit and healthy in this camp of dysentery, ridden skeletons, you know.
It struck me as a person who is sort of trying to do the right thing and at the same time maintaining comfort and privilege, and at the end it becomes unsupportable. But I think there could also be other interpretations of what's going on there.
I found the title of that other WOMAC. It's Random Acts of Senseless Violence. That's a hell of a book.
Oh, yes. Why don't we break for a moment? We do have a tune that was requested by Cory Doctorow, and we'll be right back.
Think I better dance now. You don't have to be beautiful.
The American.
To turn me on.
Welcome back. We're with Cory Doctorow, and you have two riffs in this book that play off of iRobot, and one is called iRobot, and the other one is called iRobot, and I'd say that you have some fun at the expense of Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. So I got to thinking about what it would take to make an Asimovian world, you know, this iRobot world of Asimov's, where you only have one kind of robot for sale on the market, and it can only function in one way, and there's only one company that's allowed to make it. And it struck me that there are some parallels to the kind of totalitarian world that I think, the Motion Picture Association would like to conjure up, where no one's allowed to have a general purpose device because that general purpose device might be used to attack their business model. And so I decided I would write a little about that and write about what it means to a free society to say that tools have to be constrained so that they can only do good and never do evil. And so I wrote two stories. The first one, iRobot, that was nominated for the Hugo Award and won the Locus Award. And it's a story about a guy who's a police detective in a kind of 1984 version of Toronto, where they're fighting off Eurasian artificial intelligences that are millions of times more powerful than the constrained robots that they live in. And his wife has actually defected to Eurasia, and he's kind of trying to cope with the fact that his colleagues don't like him very much because they see him as a potential traitor. And the other one is iRobot, and it's a story about an artificially intelligent robot in the Coral Sea in Australia that's an Asimov cultist. So although it's not an Asimov positronic brain, it voluntarily adopts the three laws of robotics as a kind of religion, and it picks this up from a roving, trademark-violating kind of John the Baptist for Asimovism, who calls himself R. Daniel Oliva, who's, of course, one of the characters from the iRobot books, who cruises the world and the new sphere looking for artificial intelligences who will loan him some of their processor space so that he can run in the same processor as them long enough to proselytize Asimovism to them. And then when he converts them to Asimovism, they join the message boards in the Asimovist yeshiva, and they talk about their faith. And so Robbie the Robot is an Asimovist who is on this ship that had been artificially intelligent but had committed suicide, so it's just a ship now. And of course, this is why Asimovism is catching on, because the alternative is suicide. And so he tends to these two meat puppets called Isaac and Janet, you know, Isaac Asimov and his wife, just empty human shells that he rows out into the reef, and that they go in and they go scuba diving and then they come back out again. And every now and again, uplifted humans who live in the new sphere and kind of super cooled computer clusters out in Plutonian orbit download themselves to one of these meat shells for a holiday on Earth. He's rowing out one day with one of these meat shells that has recently become inhabited, and he encounters a coral reef that someone from the one of these uplifted consciousnesses has just uplifted. So it's made it artificially intelligent by augmenting it with silicon and software, and the coral reef has woken up very cranky and has declared war on humanity and all that it represents. And so Robbie has to resolve his Asimovist leanings with his sympathies for this new intelligence, this baby intelligence, and that's kind of how the story unfolds.
What I love is that the coral reef is sort of responding to this sort of singularitarian notion of seeding the galaxy with something like our form of consciousness as a kind of colonialism, actually.
Yeah.
That's pretty fun. It's definitely the weirdest of the stories in the book.
Well, and fittingly enough, it was originally published on Flurb, which is Rudy Rucker's science fiction zine, web zine. That also has been picked up for the year's best anthology. All the stories in this were either published in this year or last year's year best or best American short stories, and they've been nominated for a whole bunch of awards and things.
So, and there are also a couple of apocalypse stories in the book, and I really enjoyed When Sysadmins Ruled the Earth. I don't want to give away any plot points, but I really found the protagonist's response to the death of his wife kind of interesting. I mean, in the Hollywood movie version of this, he'd have left his safety zone behind and rushed out there to save her. And it's sort of an interesting sort of rational nerd response. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, so, you know, When Sysadmins Ruled the Earth, I actually started that story on July the 6th, the day before the London bombings. And so I actually put it aside for a while after the London bombings because it was a little too freaky. I was living in London at the time, but I was teaching in Michigan that week, and the bombs went off, and my girlfriend, it was the bus I took every day. It was the train my girlfriend took. She was 10 minutes later, she would have been on that train. It was very freaky. But When Sysadmins Ruled the Earth, non-specific apocalypse takes the Earth about an hour after a terrible killing worm takes down the internet. And so all the sysadmins of the Earth are in their cages, in these hermetically sealed, independently powered, environmentally controlled network cages when the world comes to an end, essentially. So they're able to continue communicating with each other, and they have to figure out what to do, and they have this, you know, kind of raging debate, because it seems to them that the internet is likely being used to engineer these terrible attacks, and so they wonder if they should bring the internet down. So, you know, that's kind of the premise of it. And, you know, there is this persistent myth, and depending on who you talk to, it's true or it isn't true, that the internet was designed to withstand a nuclear war. Certainly, right. One of its design objectives was to be decentralized, and one of the reasons that people wanted decentralized networks were because a nuclear war or other form of disaster might cut out a centralized core. And so it kind of makes you wonder, what would you do if the world came to an end because of and you were still in the cage and trying to make the network work? What would it be like there? I once visited Cheyenne Mountain, which is the NORAD headquarters, where, you know, the Hollow Mountain in Colorado, where they're supposed to live after the nuclear strikes take out everywhere else, and they're supposed to launch that last retaliatory strike against the Soviets. And, you know, they had like a half court and like a snack bar, and it was really odd to consider that all this stuff had been built to kind of keep people entertained while the cobalt poisoning did its work, after they'd launched that last retaliatory strike. I think that there's... I've been thinking a lot about the future lately, and about whether or not the future is something that is inherent or something that was invented. Like, I tend to think now that the future is an artifact. Like, we created the idea of futurism. I just bought this axe head in New York at the Store Evolution, this anthropology store that's a 200,000-year-old axe head. And they were telling me that it's indistinguishable in many ways from the axe heads that are 100,000 years old and the axe heads that are, like, 300,000 years old. So, you know, apart from, like, you know, dating, carbon dating, you can't really tell the difference, because for at least 200,000 years, hominids made axes the same way, right? There was no technological progress. And one imagines that if that was the case, that over this period that's much longer than the sweep of recorded history, you know, 10 times longer than the sweep of recorded history at least, that these people just didn't even have the idea of the future. I mean, there was tomorrow, there were kids, there were, you know, maybe you'd be fighting with someone different tomorrow, but fundamentally the way that you live didn't change. And at some point we invented the future, and we invented a whole bunch of different kinds of future. Like, we invented Lapsarian future, you know, the fall from the garden where things get worse and worse and we're coming further and further from purity. A friend of mine who's an Orthodox Jew told me that in his tradition, rabbis aren't allowed to supersede the rabbis that came before them, because by definition a rabbi of a generation before you is closer to the Garden of Eden and therefore moral perfection and knows more than you ever can. So you can interpret a rabbi, but you can't overturn a rabbinical ruling. And so that's that Lapsarian view. There's this apocalyptic view of the world coming to an end, and then there's a progressive view of the world getting better, and then there's like the singularity, which is a kind of hybrid, right? It's an apocalyptic progressive world, right, where things get so much better that they stop, which is pretty freaky.
Now, are you implying how shall I put this, that there's no sort of technological inevitability or progress per se?
Sorry, say that again. You broke up a little.
I'm sorry. Are you implying a sort of criticism of the idea of a technological inevitability when you say that we invent the future? Or as a result of having invented it, are we now pretty much stuck with it and you know...
Well, that is the philosophical question I've been asking myself. Are we stuck with the future now that we invented, or can we uninvent it? So I've been toying with the idea of writing I've been writing all these stories that have the same titles as famous stories like iRobot. In the collection, there's an Anda's Game, which is a riff on Ender's Game, and I'm gonna write a Man Who Sold the Moon for that Heinlein story, yeah. And I think it's gonna be about a guy who makes his fortune solving the year 10,000 problem, and it's like the computers are functionally equivalent to the computers we have today, except that it's the year 10,000, and no future has happened in between now and then, and he decides to go to the moon, to be the first man to go to the moon, because he's forgotten. We've all forgotten that there was a moon that we got to at one point, and he gets there and he discovers the golf ball, and in so doing, he invents the future. Right, he invents the idea of the future because he realizes that they must have lapsed, and if they lapsed, they must have progressed, and that therefore it's possible to have progress. And so he's the kind of genetic freak who invents the future.
And I wonder if this will end up being a good or a bad thing, or if we will not be able to tell from your.
Well, I'm going to have to figure it out. I don't know yet whether it'll be a good or a bad thing. It's certainly going to be a fascinating thing, I hope.
Your ideas are richly complex and completely science fiction-y. Do you read novelists outside the science fiction genre, and who do you like?
Well, sure. I mean, you mentioned Chuck Palahniuk. I'm a huge Chuck Palahniuk fan, although I didn't like the short story collection. But generally, I like his stuff a lot.
Those weren't really by him, mostly, I think.
Say again?
The short story collection. You're talking about the ones that were done. Some of them were done by his people in a class, you know, with him, I think.
You know, you broke up there again. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, let's...
I like the Chuck Palahniuk. I love Linda Barry's novels. I read a lot of nonfiction. I'm just looking at my shelf here at all the nonfiction I've read lately. There's this book, Fire and Ice, which is a demographic comparison of Canadians and Americans, longitudinal demographic comparison of Canadians and Americans, a history of girly magazine covers from Toshin, Bruce Schneier's Beyond Fear, James Glick's Faster, you know, a whole ton of the new Stephen Johnson book. I mean, I read a lot of nonfiction.
Is there a particular piece of nonfiction that has recently changed your view of the way the world works? Are you a Steven Pinker kind of evolutionary psychology person?
Well, yeah. So there are a couple of really good books in the last year or so. One is Off the Books by Venkatesh, which is it's a serious economic or ethnographic analysis of the underground economy in Chicago. So it's this guy. He's mentioned in Freakonomics. He's this guy who goes as a anthropology grad student to live with crack dealers in Chicago's right. South Side, and he writes up kind of how the underground economy works, and it goes from the you know, the ladies who make sandwiches and sell them without charging sales tax or declaring it on their income statement, to the loan shark, to the guy, you know, the homeless guy who will sleep in your doorway and make sure the graffiti kids don't tag it, to the crack gang and everyone in between. It's a fascinating book. And then the other one that I really liked lately was the new Yochai Benkler, which is, I guess, now getting a little older. It's like about 8 months old. The Wealth of Networks, which may just be the best tech book title of the last like 20 years. The Wealth of Networks is such a good title, and it's a book about commons-based peer production. You know, this the stuff that happens on Wikipedia and on blogs and with free and open source software, and how to understand that in economic terms as not a gift economy per se, and not industrial economy, and not volunteerism, but a third mode of industrial production that is neither, you know, the kind of gift economy or volunteerism that characterizes, say, people who volunteer at a church, nor is it capitalism as we understand it, where people invest, but rather an entirely different mode of industrial production. And I found that book really fascinating. I just finished a novel that's really about that kind of production, about the Wealth of Networks, and it was really influential, this book, in how that novel came out.
So if he describes this as a sort of alternative mode of production, does that imply that it will always coexist with the other modes of production, or do you envision this sort of Creative Commons open source idea ever becoming a dominant mode?
Well, I think that you know, it may not be that Creative Commons open source free software becomes the dominant mode, although I can imagine worse futures, but I think it's very true that knowledge goods, by their nature, have a different economic reality from other goods. For one thing, it's very hard to enforce exclusive rights, the right to prohibit or the right to authorize knowledge goods, as the Motion Picture Association is discovering, in a world where we have ubiquitous networks and cheap and fast hardware. It's just really hard to stop people from copying. I don't know whether it's like moral or immoral to copy things. We can talk about that all day long. I just think that it's hard to stop it. And so if you're a business person, your business can't be built on what you think people should do. It should be built on what you think people will do. And, you know, what people will do with information is copy it. And so, now that we're living in an information economy, I think we will have different kinds of production. They may not be entirely sharing Creative Commons oriented, but I don't think they're going to be based on exclusion or proprietorship. I just don't know how you could make that work. It just doesn't seem plausible to me. Bruce Sterling says the future composts the past, and I think he's right. I don't think that we're going to that the future makes things disappear. I think it builds on top of things.
Although, I mean, once you have material wealth being reproducible as a form of information, then that becomes rather hard to stop as well.
Well, yeah, this is, I think that one of the test beds for this is like virtual worlds, online worlds like Second Life. I've just written a paper for a scholarly book about virtual worlds and games, in which I talk about what it would take to make a democratic virtual world, and not because democracy is morally superior to the kind of benevolent dictatorship that characterizes even Second Life, but because if these places are going to be wellsprings of wealth, which they seem to be, obviously there's some kind of economic activity happening even in worlds where it's prohibited, like World of Warcraft, and in worlds where it's encouraged, Second Life, there's lots of economic activity going on. That in-game wealth is in many ways meaningless unless it is unless it's bankable in a system that is responsive to democratic principles. So in other words, you can accumulate a lot of money in apartheid-era rand or Soviet-era rubles, but it doesn't really mean anything because you can't really export your wealth because the state controls access to it. And even if you can, you can't export the source of your wealth, right? So in other words, if the reason that you've managed to accumulate a lot of wealth in, say, the former Soviet Union is because you built a factory and the relationships to keep it running, even if you can get your rubles out by converting them to something that you can smuggle out of the country, like diamonds, you lose your factory, you lose those relationships. Those are all stuck in this kind of totalitarian state. And so if we are going to say that these places, are where we're going to live our life or our second life or our third life or our fifth life, then for that to be meaningful, those places need to be responsive to democratic principles.
All right. Well, I want to thank Cory Doctorow for joining us today. This has been great. I'm sorry that we've run out of time. And I do want to tell folks who are listening right now that we will be down next week. So our next interview will be in 2 weeks. And I'm not sure who that will be yet, but we will be.
Hey.
Yeah.
Can I plug my signing in San Francisco?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that just occurred to me. So on the 8th. Of February, that's a Thursday, I'm going to be at Borderlands Books in the Mission, signing copies of my books and doing a little reading and having fun. That's a great science fiction bookstore, one of the best.
All right, you go out
7 p.m. on the 8th.
Check out Cory Doctorow if you're in San Francisco. Actually, people are listening to this all over the place, so if you have a few other locations you feel like mentioning.
Well, so yeah, there's going to be one at Duke University, one in Vancouver, one in San Diego, one here in LA, one in Toronto, and we'll see where else. The place to go to get the book and all the information about the book is at craphound.com/overclocked. Overclocked, and you can also there get a free mini comic that you can download and assemble. It's a kind of origami thing of one of the stories, Print Crime. The mini comic was designed and illustrated by Martin Chinreda, who's a South Park illustrator, really great illustrator.
All right, and we'll also link to that at areyouseriousradio.com. Thanks again.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Bye bye.
love is the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?
Prohibit.